Welcome, this is Dave. I hope you're each doing great. You had an extra week for some of this material to kind of marinate in your minds, and I'm eager to hear any thoughts or reflections or questions that you have from what we've talked about before or what you've encountered in terms of any of its application. Anything that we haven't addressed that you'd like to raise or highlight here before we move into our final seminar? We did talk earlier about confidence and confidence being a state of mind. I have since posted a blog on that. You guys have inspired me. It is the most recent blog. It's accessible through my website, Mentor Path, and there's a tab at the top for blog. And you can sign up for the blog if you want to receive it in an ongoing way. And the blog is about confidence being a state of mind. And it kind of follows from our second seminar about mastery of states of mind. So thoughts, questions, comments, things that you want to be sure that we address before the end of our time this evening. Any input, questions? The things that I think that you'll really see a great deal of in terms of working with professionals, there are two or three areas that I think so much of our work with professionals really orbits around, whether that's professionals in the sense of practicing professionals, docs, architects, attorneys, coaches, or performing professionals such as actors, pro athletes. And one of these, I think, especially overlaps a lot with what we see with working with executives and especially CEOs, is really about education, training, coaching, about social and emotional intelligence, really looking at and understanding one's own dynamics and interacting with the dynamics of others. Another, as we spent all of Seminar 2 on, is regulating states of mind and what a crucial impact that has for optimum performance and really to get to a position of optimum performance. And another area that we really haven't touched on that's been outside the scope of this seminar is about marketing professional practice and or the professionals themselves. And that's something that I know there have been some questions about that. I'm going to send around a link to a seminar series that I began tomorrow on that to respond to some of your questions rather than discussing it right now, because that would take us away from our focus here. So any other thoughts or questions before we begin our seminar for this time? How has this impacted how you're thinking and working with clients? Any responses to that? I'm very interested in how this has impacted how you're thinking and approaching your work with clients. If it's had an impact, and if so, how? Anyone?
Hi, Dave. This is Juan.
Thank you. I was feeling lonely. Go ahead, please. That's good. Yeah. Go ahead.
My feeling is that the culture's state of mind, and I can, in other ways, like the energy, can big affect the how clients feel you or how clients see the value of you. Even I know that sometimes I like can't control myself. It's like I know my practice has value, but when I talk to them, kind of got feeling like it's difficult to persuade them, difficult to let them to completely understand how important to regulate mind and how to have emotion balance. So I think I also need to be participate in this seminar. Just like I know the basic theory, but I haven't completely experienced by myself to really understand it. Got it.
Okay, I think that's a really important concept, and I think that that the sense of value and conveying that will come from our own state of mind of confidence. And I know a couple of you have heard this already from me. I want to give you guys two quizzes. And I want you to really think about these quizzes because they have to do with really developing a practice and especially developing a practice with professionals. One is the Wharton School of Business surveyed several thousand professionals to examine the major factor to determine if someone engaged with the professionals or not. And it was the same reason both ways. Which one of these was it? Years of experience, reputation, amount of the fee, degrees and certifications, stating recommendations and fee clearly and confidently, state of the economy. Second quiz, Carnegie Mellon did a large study to determine the major factor for professionals earning the trust of others and therefore becoming clients. Which one of these four was it? An established, proven expert, the confidence of the professional, demonstrated current expertise, reputation, and credentials. The answer for both of these is the confidence of the professional. That's the most important thing that will determine whether you're going to get and keep a client and engage a client to do the kind of magic that you'll do with mentor coaching. So that's something to really pay attention to. Look at the blog, because the blog is about confidence being a state of mind and how important that is, but also what a determinant it is in how someone will engage with us or not. So that's a really important factor. And there's been a great deal of research that has shown that confidence trumps competence in terms of the success of people in business. And that's pretty striking. Confidence becomes more important than competence in terms of determining whether someone will be a success in business. One of the most powerful recent books I've read is The Confidence Code. And two journalists, one from America, one from BBC, have done a very extensive and exhaustive series of research by talking with a lot of people in neuroscience about confidence, and I would highly recommend their book called The Confidence Code. And it really looks at the process of confidence. They don't actually say it, as I do, that confidence is a state of mind, but they talk about the various factors of confidence and how it's how it's skewed by gender and some startling factors there. So I actually bought it for my wife and wanted her to read. She's in a master's in HR and a PhD in psychology program right now, and I really wanted her to see some of the research that's being done there, and it's some amazing stuff. So I would recommend that. So I hope that's kind of a beginning answer or at least a direction for that question, because I think it's really a good question, because what someone will not respond to is trying to convince them with the facts of here's the value and here's the here are the studies and that sort of thing. There are some powerful facts about coaching. There are four major studies about the value of coaching. Three are by the Lore Institute, L-O-R-E Institute, that show a composite 6 times the value, a return on investment of 6 to 1. For every dollar invested, it's an average of $6 return. The range is from 5 to 10. Another is by the Manchester Consulting Group, and it shows the same range, but basically a 6-fold return on investment. So sometimes when you're working with an executive group, you have to enter by the right brain and look at return on investment and that sort of thing. but then it's really something beyond just facts and figures that really determine whether someone is going to sign on for you. It's if they believe in you, and that's determined by if you believe in yourself, this is going to be a midbrain to midbrain kind of communication. So I hope that's a beginning answer. And as I have mentioned to a couple of you, I will send a link to the teleseminar series that I begin tomorrow about it's a four-part series on the psychology of influence, the neuroscience of persuasion, mastery mindset development, and neuromarketing of professional practice. And this has particular implication for what we've been talking about. So thanks for that. I appreciate the question. I hope this sort of begins to give you an idea of an answer. Other thoughts or questions that you'd like to discuss before we move into the material?
Hi, this is Rosemary. I just want to say that I called in a few minutes late.
Okay, great. Thanks. Any questions or comments that you'd like us to focus on? Or anyone?
Thank you, Dave. Sorry, I just jumped offline for 3 seconds. Just get back.
Okay. All right, great. Well, I'll put us on lecture mode and move into the material and preserve some time at the end for our discussion. As you see from the outline, there are a number of special topics in coaching professionals that I want to touch on, because I think these are important aspects that I often don't see in the coaching literature or approached somewhere else, and I think that they're important to look at. One is in the sense of coaching from the inside out, to look at sense of self. Let me tell you what I mean by that. Let me first give you an example. An esteemed trial attorney had reached a high watermark in her career and made these observations. After you've advanced in your work, at some point, there's no one else in the system, and for her, the firm, to give you good feedback besides yourself. If you're really good, they're either jealous or overly admiring, and there's no one more senior. I mean, she really captured a dynamic that I see very frequently. I've run out of people to idealize, to look up to. At first, when I recognized that, I felt a little lost. The greatest favor another attorney did early in my career was when I went to him and I said, "How am I doing?" He said, "Only you can tell." At first, I got mad. Later, I realized how that remark helped me develop my own self-reliance and validation, and that I needed collaboration with a mentor coach, someone objective at various points. So, 2 points here. First, what we have to do as mentor coaches is provide accurate and explicit feedback. No one around the professional can get away with very direct, explicit feedback except us. Not the clients, the patients, the staff, the colleagues, teammates, other people in the executive suite. We're obligated, in my view, to give feedback to someone who has come to believe the expectations of others that are idealized, grand, exaggerated. As coaches, we can be empathic while we can also be bold and direct. The professional needs this balance. It's hard to leave the firm or the hospital or the sports arena where they're treated like gods to go home and take out the garbage. And there's no scrub nurse or assistant to hand the diaper. But we know we can help them change their lives for the better. So here's an application of the sense of self. Self-esteem versus shame. The bedrock of personal success is a positive, cohesive sense of self and clear, attainable internal ideals. To be true to an inner design, someone must have an inner design. Ideals give focus, meaning, and organization to ambition. Another simple way to say that, the only place that I know that self-esteem comes from is from having internal ideals and living up to them. A sense of self consists of self-image and body image, personality, functioning, the organization of all personal experience. Self is the prefix for esteem, confidence, identity, initiative, the concept of self and the experience of self serve as an internal point of reference and a center of independent initiative. So I want to reiterate here, when you live up to your ideals, when they're attainable, not perfection, but when they're attainable, when you live up to your ideals, the result is self-esteem and a sense of wholeness. The feeling is that your life has meaning. When you don't, the result is shame. Ideals and needs are at the core of identity, part of the foundation of self. We talked about that and saw the exercises in the first seminar. Ideals are internal standards of excellence. They serve as a personal model of value, an internal guide to purpose. Living up to a personal, attainable ideal generates a sense of worth and esteem. Failure to live up to an internal ideal results in a feeling of shame. Shame can be pervasive over a lifetime, while it can remain masked to its creator. Shame is the worst feeling that you can have because there's nothing you can do about it. It's not something you've done or done wrong or transgressed. It's who you are, in a sense. Now, here are some examples of gender-specific expressions of attempts to counter this sense of shame. For females, to be perfect, pretty, thin, quiet, helpful, loving, giving to others, or the desire to spend and shop to counter the unconscious whispers of, you need to look better. For males, to be stoic, strong, unemotional, do more, make more, or the desire to compete physically or by expensive acquisitions to counter the unconscious whispers of, you need to have evidence of worth. So the pursuit of more may not be combined with the clarity of what constitutes enough. In other words, more doesn't have an endpoint any more than perfect does. So be sure that when you hear this pursuit in a client, that you have helped them define what enough is, what a goal is. Here's an example. Ron consulted me when he ran out of wall space. And this literally was the precipitating incident. He had just received a coveted national award as one of the outstanding individuals in the country in architectural design. He placed the award on the only remaining space on his wall. The walls of his office, as well as his trophy case, were now completely filled with awards and medals. He had already met his goal of yearly earnings of $500,000. With each accomplishment, he bargained with himself that the next success would make him feel complete and happy. His pursuit of happiness, though, seemed elusive, but yet still somehow attainable. Each higher monetary goal offered the hope of contentment. In other words, every year he would set his goal a little bit further out to be sure he didn't reach it, to be sure that he preserved hope. Years ago, he believed he would feel comfortable when he had the security of fully funding his retirement plan. Well, he did that. After that, he upped the ante, pay off his house mortgage. Then upped the ante, pay off the mortgage on his vacation property. Then to have a net worth of $5 million. He recognized that he was trying to make money speak the language of fulfillment, yet it wasn't saying back to him what he wanted. There were no more admired colleagues, more senior than he, to applaud him. There were no higher awards to achieve. He didn't need more money. He was not happy, but now his hope of contentment seemed sort of illusory. Money had kept score, but he wasn't quite sure of what. He recognized his orientation to money, how he used it to garner the responses and admiration of others, how it was a yardstick for him, a metric. Each round of applause worked for a little while, but never well enough for long enough. He felt a continued desire for more, yet the more never made him happy. He was finally confronted with his illusion that more would be enough when he simply ran out of wall space for more awards. He felt lost and had a baffled review that was crystallized of what was missing. And Ron admonished me not to take his symbolism too lightly, such as, well, Dave, I've never seen a problem that money made worse. And I know money can't buy happiness. Then again, happiness can't buy government-insured bonds. But he was able, even with the joking back and forth, to do some serious work. And I asked him a series of questions, including, what is it you do uniquely well better than anyone else? What's your greatest passion? What hidden gift or talent do you think you have that may deserve a new special place in your life? Is there an unlived part of your life? Look at the blog on unlived life. And it's a different perspective that I think you might find interesting. What kind of things make your heart happy? When do you catch yourself smiling? Who does it feel like is currently most in charge of your life? His ideals centered on achievement and mastery, yet his goals of further awards and more money, by definition, could never be met. There's no end point to more. Ron quickly recognized that his fundamental needs to be acknowledged and be cared for were only partially met by his goals. His needs and ideals were not in alignment with his goals or his passion. After some reflection, he decided to devote some professional time, his actual professional time, to architectural projects that he selected for different reasons. He chose projects where he could do uniquely well rather than taking on all of the business, and those he felt passionate about. He also shifted from his work ethic of putting in 12 to 14 hours a day to a productivity and success ethic with goals that allowed satisfaction with each day's accomplishments. The transition resulted in Ron working more happily, making actually even more money, but having significantly greater personal time. He devoted some of his excess time to funding and organizing Big Brother events, which gave him tremendous sense of gratification. Let's shift now to strategies with the resistant client, because I think you'll find in working with professionals that there may be more of what you would traditionally think about as the resistant client with professionals, because they're accustomed to being right, they're accustomed to giving answers, they're accustomed to having people agree with them doing things the way they want to do things. And practicing professionals tend to be more resistant than other clients at times, partly because of personality type that mitigated the going into what they're doing, lengthy training, and a series of successes to get where they are. They're accustomed to being the expert. Performance professionals are accustomed to being the hero from actually even before grade school through college. And they're then on a team where everyone can't be a hero ultimately. Actors have been stars all their lives. Then they have to deal with moments outside the limelight. So here are some strategies, and this is in your outline. Here are some strategies of dealing with change with challenging professional clients. One, remember, you can't determine what anyone else does. You can only offer suggestions or be a catalyst. The suggestions need to be made from a collaborative, collegial position, and they're most likely to have impact from that collaborative framework. This is the most important framework, I think, that we have as coaches is to remember that it's one of collaboration. That distinguishes us from every other professional who we'll deal with. Their model is of consultancy or some variation of that. Two, the relationship itself is the change agent. The most important thing is what happens while we're talking about other things. The process of everything from confidence to the modeling of how to engage the social and emotional intelligence that we have in relating to someone. Three, don't take it personally. Put your ego in a blind trust, in other words. Four, remember that clients are the experts of their lives. Remember how adaptive their authority role has been. Five, you're most likely to create action in a resistant client if you don't attempt to do so. Six, state your understanding of the client's experience as best you can. state your understanding of the client's intention as best you can. That way the client will know that you get it and get what it's like to be him or her. 8, check with the client to see if both understanding and intention are correct, if you're right, in other words. Then find out from your challenging client what they have managed to do a little that they'd like to do more. Basic coaching stuff. Find out what clients have not done yet that they would like to do in a future similar situation. Highlight solutions that don't work along with empathic resonance of how frustrating it must be. Find out if the client is willing to try something different, to redirect efforts and pursue a particular goal in a different way. Ask how the client may want to redirect efforts toward the goal. Invite the client to try something different that would be simple and specific in the beginning, that would actually be the easiest thing to do, one small step at a time. Then you can look at clarifying the SMART goals, the overarching goals, and co-create a strategy or system to address the task. Remember, any pattern can be changed with a different interaction. Someone can change a pattern by changing the where, what, who, when, how of the pattern. Consider having the client visualize arriving at a goal. This visualization begins with the destination, and actually, if repeated, will rewire someone's brain so you can work backward to see the steps necessary to arrive. It creates the success scenario in someone's experience, and when it's repeated, it becomes etched in the brain, so then it's a matter of only strategically backing into it. And the first step for the client who has a fixed finger pointed at others is to acknowledge the impossibility of changing someone else. The assumption that someone or something else must change in order for that person to be happy ensures ineffectiveness and frustration. So just a couple of practical suggestions. When someone is stuck, and these are questions about belief and behavior to ask. If someone is really genuinely stuck, and the client will say, what I want is, and then they fill in the blank, but I'm really stuck. So a couple of things that we might ask. What would I be able to observe in your behavior and know that? To know what it is that you really want. What would I be able to observe in your behavior and know that? In other words, if somebody's stuck, are they behaving in a way that I would know from that behavior that what they want to do? Usually the answer is no. What behavior would demonstrate that you are acting to do that? In other words, let's look at what's the next best thing, how to create an action item from this that you would initiate. Is there a component of that that you could begin doing now to get traction? What's the most important piece of new behavior to establish in order to move forward? And can you describe how you'd feel if you did what you said you wanted to do? Because we are motivated by how we're going to feel. We do something or don't do something by how we feel about it. That's the common denominator. When someone is not doing something that they want to do, it's some anticipation of how they're going to feel that is keeping them from doing it. That's the basic motivator. And think about the two fundamental aspects of what will determine what someone does. And we're wired for this also, by the way, to avoid pain and to seek pleasure. And both of these are to feel a certain way. If someone is doing something that they don't want to do, or even more specifically, if there's something they're not doing, and they have a plan, an intention, a desire to do it, if it's their goal to do it, and they're not doing it, then there's something about it that they associate with pain. And this may not be obvious, it may not make sense to them, but there's something they associate with doing it that they connect with pain, so they don't do it. No matter how well planned and how logical and conscious it is to want to do it, there's something that they associate with pain. Consider, and we've touched on this before, consider if someone has a plan, and a strategy, and a powerful desire to generate more money and to create wealth. If they don't do it, they associate some kind of pain to it, even though it may not make sense or be logical or conscious. They associate pain of, this wouldn't really be the right thing. It may be unspiritual. I'd be all alone. I really wouldn't know how to do it. There's something that they associate with pain that may or may not be conscious. That's the shadow story. So we need to look at that. So, and remember that a new belief requires a new neural network to support it. The most common thing that someone does is to add a new pattern or a new behavior onto the ones that already exist. And that usually is not successful because that neural network of the behaviors that already exist are still there. And just adding something new to it is usually not going to make it successful. And remember, too, that it's not information that is going to change behavior. If information would change behavior, we'd all be thin, we'd work out every day, we'd eat primarily vegetables, and we'd have significant money saved. So it's not information that changes behavior any more than we decide or buy from our rational mind. We do it from our emotional mind. So just some things to keep in mind. Now, I want to talk a little bit about life mission statement. Jot down any questions you have, and we'll come back to them. About life mission statement. Professional clients frequently have a need to examine the balance between their personal and professional lives. This need for balance may be a blind spot, and the coach may need to initiate consideration. One approach is to generate a life mission statement, analogous to a business mission statement. A life mission statement looks at the meaning, use, value, and purpose. Those four things, meaning, use, value, and purpose of someone's life. And this includes basic ideals and needs that we've talked about, whether the client is meeting them or not, and the process for achieving this mission. And those four components is part of the statement. So, some questions maybe to ask to help someone fashion a life mission statement. What are the central themes of your current life story? What do you want the central themes of your life story to be? What really matters most to you? Are your ideals and needs in harmony with your goals and strategy? And this is something we will perhaps need to assess independently of that, and why I think it's helpful to get a clear idea of what the most important needs and the most important ideals are for a client and see if they fit with goals and strategy. So there are some aspects of new learning, and I think this is important change. There are patterns of new learning. There are four phases of new learning. Have you considered this? Why does someone begin a new endeavor like coaching with such excitement and then seem to lose it several weeks into the work? I consistently heard my coaching students puzzle about why their clients would stall or just kind of drop off at about a month or two, or kind of wonder, is this all there is? Well, there are some phases of new learning, but part of that answer is the initial experience involves a very different kind of nervous system, a part of our brain that looks at the anticipation, the excitement, and the stimulation of something that's new and different. Once we get accustomed to something, we move from the sprint system of our brain to the long distance running, and that's the neuroepinephrine. That's the system that's no longer the adrenaline, the cortisol, the excitement, but it's that our brain has become adaptive to sustain for the long run. So this doing it for the long run, moving to the marathon mode, can read as, well, this is not as exciting as it used to be, or isn't there anything more? So we need to kind of ladder this and look at this, and this is why I think these phases of new learning are important, and also the dynamics of change and transition we'll talk about in just a moment. So there are four phases of new learning. First, the art. Initial confusion and excitement sort of combine to launch a new learning. Awareness of the unfamiliar and the uncertain can register as curiosity, sometimes just plain anxiety, mixed in with excitement that propels emotion. Secondly, increasing confidence, both with the experience of effectiveness and with positive feedback, then falls into place. Thirdly, mastery is the consistent experience of effectiveness and movement to a new level of excitement and validation, and creates its own sense of flow, which is a kind of state of mind of really feeling in the groove and things going well. And then the fourth is entropy, E-N-T-R-O-P-Y, which occurs when the excitement and the invigoration of the learning curve, newness and mastery, level off or decline. Even a leveling off may register as a lessening of this ever-increasing acquisition of mastery, pleasure, and reward, and may result in disillusionment. And the client raises the question of, is this all there is? Or, you know, I don't seem to be as excited about this anymore. And now, secondly, the science. The brain also plays a role in this process. Dopamine is the brain chemical that induces excitement by anticipating pleasure or reward. The rush from dopamine release motivates people to take risks. This is exciting. It adds to the dopamine release, too. But neuroscientists have shown that anticipating a reward is even more exciting than actually receiving it. Why? Because receiving a reward shuts down the anticipatory release of dopamine and along with it the accompanying positive feelings and high energy. This explains the paradox that the expectation of an event is more exciting than an actual event when it occurs. And there are a number of examples of this. An investor will feel more positive when expecting a stock to rise, yet not as excited as anticipated when it actually does. Or the purchase of a big ticket item, a new car that you've anticipated for a long time, isn't quite as exciting as you expected. Or, as I mentioned, clients hit plateaus in coaching after 1 to 2 months. So what we can do in coaching is to foster attitudes that promote curiosity and openness, which introduce new learning. Learning is always a choice, a potential creation. There are many different levels of learning, both internally and externally. Learning does not always have to be converted into action or into a specific metric of success. Now, I want to look with you a bit at change and transition now. And I want to preserve sufficient time for discussion at the end. So I'm going to abbreviate this, but I want to hit the highlights here because I think this is an important aspect of work that we do. And understanding the overview and the dynamics here, I think, can be really important. The change is the event, the situation. You change a behavior, you move to a new city, have a baby, take a new job. As we focus on change, we address the rituals of change, the work tools, the SMART goals. The transition is the process. It's the internal story of change, a shift in orientation, even in self-definition. Transition is attention to the seasonal cycles as well as the daily weather. We help clients change and embrace transition to let go of the old story, the outlived chapter, and evolve into the new story. Now, I think there are four important aspects or components of transition. And this is something just for your conceptualization to really listen to a story, not that you're going to see exact evidence of it in lockstep sequence in your clients. But this is just to keep in mind because there are going to be elements of it in every work with a client that has to do with change and transition, which is every work with a client. One, every transition begins with an ending. willingly or unwillingly, an ending. It involves letting go of familiar, habitual routines to establish new patterns. So, never underestimate the need and the power of letting go. To move to a new position, you have to relinquish a past one. To do things in a new way, you have to end the way you do them now. Remember, we talked about you can't just add a pattern on to everything that exists. You have to disrupt the pattern that you're doing now in order to make change. To become something new, you have to give up some of the old self. To transition to a new possibility, you have to let go of something familiar. Two, people in transition will create new ways to return to the old story. Now, we've talked about the mind and brain reasons for change and how that's difficult and how to facilitate that change. Every ending is followed by some distress or confusion. This is a crucial juncture in coaching. We help a client conceptualize this as an expectable part of change and transition. Ending, confusion, new beginning. People will resist both the change and the transition. They will return to the familiar. And we can help them reframe this return to the familiar as perhaps a way of measuring progress, a validation of moving ahead, and just to be sure that you and the client both believe in this process. Three, the new beginning involves changing how you see yourself, even aspects of your identity. Now, the impact and meaning of the transition may bear little resemblance to the apparent significance of the change that caused it. Now, this can be confusing at first. Someone can be discombobulated by a seemingly minor illness because it shatters an illusion of vulnerability, of invulnerability. And another person can take the loss of a parent in stride, but yet be devastated when they lose their dog. You know, some people are kind of one tragedy behind. So it's not always the magnitude of the current event. It's what it means and the cumulative impact of it. Four, never underestimate the change back pressure from the system. In addition to the individual who has his or her own change back pressure, the family, the company, it's their collective self-statement of reaction to change. It's an attempt to restore normal order and not do the work of change. Jung said the most important problems can't be solved. They have to be outgrown. I want to mention one aspect particularly here about adapting to success, because this is something I think you will increasingly see in your practices and see on a regular basis in dealing with successful people. Success is never final. No one can become complacent and sustain success. We have to test. We have to test ideas out, revise them. We have to continue to write our own story in a way that didn't just get us to success, but to sustain success. One reason to be very clear about your needs and ideals and to have a clear idea of your story is to deal with success. It's at least as challenging to deal with success as it is with adversity or scarcity. And my prediction, each of you will have a new level of success that you haven't had before, so be ready for it. Now, a couple of examples. The writer F. Scott Fitzgerald had just completed his novel, This Side of Paradise. He was riding high, a successful writer in every aspect. He had just married a beautiful wife, had a storybook life. Then Fitzgerald said, riding in a taxi one afternoon between very tall buildings under a really rosy sky, I just began to bawl. I had everything I wanted, and I knew I would never be so happy again. The problem, he felt, is that every story must end, which, of course, is what he experienced as a writer. He then descended into depression and alcoholism and died an early death. Elvis became the story of success, but it wasn't that story that brought him to success. However, he identified with the success story and lost himself in it. His true story ended as he lay cold on the bathroom floor at age 42, full of drugs and the trappings of success. These are two guys who needed mentor coaches, not to become successful, but to deal with and sustain and grow success. Failure and success are both stories, external stories about events, meaning that you have to continue with efforts and change to sustain success. Either story, failure or success, can change. It can continue, it can grow, or it can end. To continue with a success story is to continue doing that which created the success. After you arrive at success, you can't stop doing the things that created the success and only inhabit the success story, the things having to do with success and its enjoyment. Soon then, success will wither and the story change, and you can become defined by the story. So it's not wealth, position, possessions, or even a chase of happiness that creates problems. It's when you lose yourself in the chase. So we've talked about our operating systems, and you're aware of how computers have operating systems. Within the hardware and comprising the programs is a complex system of software that contains instructions, protocols, and couplings that enable the system to function smoothly. Usually, we only think about the operating system when there are problems or failings. Now, let's use the example of your money story. It has a similar operating system with a set of beliefs and assumptions about your behaviors. There are various theories and disciplines that each have perspectives on this system of human behavior that ultimately downloads as your own story that you tweak to make it uniquely yours. Consider that these downloads operate smoothly within a system. But if they don't work, then the downloads themselves are faulty. So this can be the shadow story. For example, thinking that if you're not born with money, you'll never have money. Equating education with an entitlement to wealth. Assuming that book smart will make you street smart. Focusing on rich and forgetting about wealth. Focusing on making and spending money rather than making your money work for you. Not seeing yourself as capable of making a lot of money results in not making a lot of money. Expecting things to happen quickly. Waiting for motivation in order to generate the energy and personal business plan to succeed. These are just some examples of assumptions that can ghostwrite behavior that we listen for in coaching, and especially we listen for these with professionals, because they often have these stories that become crucially interwoven in their experience and need to have them addressed by us and together collaboratively. So, in summary, the clearer we are about what we want, the more power we have. Success results from being all of who we really are and having all of ourselves go in the same direction. Self-validation and affirmation result from having an internal ideal, a sense of what good enough is, an endpoint, in other words, and consistently attaining it. We each uniquely define our own meaning of success and fulfillment. Individual success involves a full understanding of what we create, both to facilitate and to interfere with success. Revising a life story begins with changing our minds as well as our behavior, because we are authoring the fundamental plot and storylines. Past, present, and future, all are current constructions. We perceive only for that for which we have a map, in other words, a framework or paradigm, to recognize it. Fear, adventure, change are all synonyms, just viewed from a different spot. Change can occur from the inside out or be initiated on the outside, requiring adaptation to it. Change may simply be a different way of looking at something, a new way of thinking, or openness to feeling and reflection to what was previously unknown or foreclosed, which is one of the things we do as coaches, is to perturbate a closed system. we each have to see and experience for ourselves the advantage of change, and we have to judge what needs to remain the same, as it may be difficult to resist some changes, for example, impulsive decisions. If we find ourselves resisting change, it has already occurred. And change is difficult. It's just that the only thing harder is not doing it. So, a very brief summary overview of coaching professionals. Professional, and now I'm going to try to wrap up in a very succinct way the highlights of what we've talked about, just kind of in bullet form. Professionals often subjugate their true selves to their roles, the expectations of others that the professional is the expert. Professionals then often live into that perception. They feel they always have to be right. And someone's life, lawsuit, tax payment, finances, shelter, or career pivots on their rightness. So, in working with these clients, remember how adaptive their authority role has been. Don't take anything personally. And this is to say in a different way, the client is doing everything possible to show you exactly what it's like to be him or her. Learn from it so that we can teach it back to the client. Always keep the professional client as the point of reference. Set a mission statement with expectations for coaching. This is to you, the coach. Balance art and science. Practice the art. Let me say that a different way. Practice the science of the art by entering the engagement with your left brain, linear thinking, reason, intellect, and follow with your right brain, creativity, intuition, emotion. Hold a mirror up to the professional to see what he or she knows already but has not yet seen. Be accountable to the professional, a sounding board to say what they're not hearing from anyone else. Focus on outcomes. Emphasize behaviors, not intentions. Remember that the professional has little or no training in marketing or in business. For this, you may need to act as advisor and consultant. Even more important than coaching, collaboration and brainstorming. Work together in a joint intellectual effort. You will be involved in several roles with a professional. To name a few, coach, collaborator, mentor, brainstormer, advisor, Dutch uncle. And remember this, beliefs drive behavior. Behavior drives performance. So, we've discussed many aspects of enhancing your effectiveness as a coach with professional clients in this art and science of coaching professionals. My intent has been to help you recognize your expertise and expand it in this specialty niche, as well as to add to your repertoire of experience and operating principles with all of your clients. I'm going to go to discussion mode. And I'm eager to hear thoughts or questions or comments that any of you have. Or just clarifications of anything that we've talked about that would be helpful to elaborate a bit.
Dave, this is Dorita.
Please, go ahead.
How are you?
Great.
So I printed out a lot of the documents that I saw online and everything, and so what you talked about today, what was that, or is that something that you were just going over? I was taking a lot of notes.
What I was talking about today is in the outline that you, there are four seminars of outlines, and what I mentioned today is in the outline for seminar four. And it's called Special Topics in Coaching Professionals. So this should be in what you've downloaded and already printed.
In the earlier editions that have the outline and the workbook?
Yes, The outline of all four of the of the seminars is was on that page that you went to initially, and the page that has the playback for each of the seminars, and that will remain up for CTA does it for about 30 days after the final seminar, so it'll be up for about a month after this.
Okay, I have it.
Does that answer your question?
It does. I was actually using some search keywords to locate it, and I wasn't finding it. So I just was making sure I was actually following, you know, the same document. So.
Okay.
Okay.
Usually those search words don't work with a PDF, and the outline and the downloads are PDF. So it may not be, it may not work as well as a simple Word document.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks. Other thoughts or questions? We still have a few minutes.
Hi, Dave. This is Yolanda.
Welcome. Hey.
I first of all want to say thank you very much for a quite informative class that you've provided for us over these last few weeks.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for your comments.
You're welcome. And just something that comes up whenever I'm taking any class, people are always talking about right brain versus left brain, and, you know, being a left-handed person, I have to look at it the other way sometimes, and I'm like, okay, so are we thinking logically with the left brain or the right brain, you know? So
your handedness is independent of the essential functions of the more emotional brain, and it's a gross over simplification to say right brain equals emotional, intuitive, creative, and left brain equals logical, conscious, reason. That's a gross oversimplification, but that is independent of handedness.
That's great. I'm glad, because I felt silly asking the question, but thank you.
And I think these aspects are so important in coaching, because in my view, and as you know, what I bring to coaching is to integrate psychology, neuroscience, behavioral economics with strategic coaching, because I think when we really understand how the mind and the brain work, that we can help our clients create changes that last and really put that in practical, simple ways to deconstruct it and look at the simplicity of change and to facilitate that and ways to make change that lasts.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Was there any other follow-up to that or other aspect of that that would be helpful?
No, that was all for now, but thank you so much for everything.
Absolutely.
Dave, this is Dorita one last time.
Please.
As we're looking at issues of when you're saying, okay, don't take it personal and you take your ego out of it and you're working toward moving them, but this may be a more resistant client, or they revert back and change behavior. When we're talking about all of those things, what are some key, I guess maybe thoughts in the moment from a coaching perspective to stay sort of back in neutral, to stay on, you know, stay on five and not, you know, I guess you get tempted sometimes to, you know, want that for them, if that makes any sense.
Okay. A couple of things in response to that, and I think this is going to be directed at your question. One is the most important thing that we can do before meeting with each client is to spend just a moment to get really centered and grounded before we take that call, before the client calls us. I'm speaking as if you're working by telephone, which I do, and it may be in person, but it's still a moment to really get grounded and centered, so that you have full range and scope and access to all of your states of mind and all the information, so that you can truly be immersed in listening from that client's experience and to take an empathic position to listen from inside their experience and come to know their subjective reality, how they put together things, how they process, and what their experience is, because that's the point of reference from which you'll be working, is the client's point of reference. Now, I think it's also helpful to recognize that the client is going to recreate everything that's important to that client, including attachment and behavior patterns, in the process with you. So you're going to get an idea of what it's like to be that person. They're going to teach you exactly what it's like to be them. Look at, you remember from the first seminar that we did, the example that I gave from the training, the internal mentoring program, the woman who volunteered to do a demo coaching with me, how she recreated the process of what she was experiencing with her client with me. And it was by not taking it personally, by not trying to, you know, show the group what a good coach I was or try to get her to do something, that I could really resonate with her experience and how she was recreating her frustration and her experience with that client with me, so that I could stay focused on the client and knowing that she was showing me what it was like to be her, that she recreated the process. So this is tough sometimes when an attachment pattern is to be antagonistic or to be aloof, that we don't take it personally because we're taking all of this as the client's experience and as information that we're going to use in helping the client to strategically move ahead to goals and initiatives that they want and need. So hopefully this is a beginning answer. I know we're out of time. Thank you all very much. It's been a true privilege. I've really enjoyed putting together some ideas and thoughts for you and your input and questions. It's helped me shape some of what I say. It's been a privilege to work with you, and I'll be eager to hear how things go, and I hope we don't lose contact. I'll do an email follow-up for the couple of questions that some of you have had about additional material. So thanks very, very much.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you, Dave.
Absolutely.
One quick question, if I may.
Okay.
I tried going on the website today, and I saw that the website was down. I know you said you had contacted, I think it was Bill from Tech, to make sure that they got everything running. So if you could just follow up with them, make sure that they're doing that, I'd greatly appreciate it.
The CTA website of the playback for this seminar?
Yes.
Okay, I'll do that. Okay.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.